Twitter.com/KPFT, Facebook.com/KPFT Houston.
You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of Technology Bites here on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Wow, this is like the first time that we've had this shape hole in our formation.
A house shaped hole.
where is the house hole? We're flying in missing geek formation. We have no Groove House.
Groove House 54, where are you?
Where can my Groove House be?
I guess we should check Twitter.
You might have tweeted something at us. I don't know. All right. Well, welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And he's...
That may be Groove House at the door. Was there someone just ringing that? Or am I hearing things?
No, that was Skype.
Oh, okay.
That was Skype. Yeah, I don't know what happened to Groove House. He's, I maybe got offended at my,
Anybody try calling him? Maybe he's asleep.
I just put the Twitter signal out, so. Anyway, well.
We don't need cell phones, we've got Twitter.
Funny enough, you know, we have a nice intro. Pete's actually online right at the beginning. We're not struggling with Skype that I can tell. And then Groove House just pulls this. I guess maybe I offended him when I said something about Sprint. I forgot he was a Sprint user. He's still got that cough, do you, Pete?
Yeah, a little bit. It's not like last week. Last week I absolutely could not have done the show. It would not have worked. There would not be enough muting time to do the show and cough too.
Right. All right. Well, we're glad everybody could tune in tonight, and we're glad you're here. The weather out there is looking a little strange. It's starting to cloud up and getting kind of windy. They say we got some bad weather coming this weekend. So if you if you've been putting off buying a surge protector, this might be the weekend. You might want to get one before the weekend. I think Flicked looks like he's talking to his high school crush or something. I wonder if he called Groove House. What have you got there, Flicked? Was he asleep?
This was the report.
The week that he's on disaster preppers or whatever?
This was, hello, my learning girl. Okay, so are you awake? I'm on my way.
Poor guy.
Maybe he'll get here in time to get calls after the news.
So we may see him or we may not.
Just get calls after the snooze.
You had him in that dream state. You should have added some surreal stuff to it.
Should have put him on the air.
The test started 20 minutes. Did you study? Or
don't forget the waffles.
Yeah, bring waffles and extra syrup.
Dude, where's my show? All right, well, visit us online at geekradio.com. We might have a picture of Groove House on the website somewhere, so you'll know who we're talking about. You can also hang out with us, IRC. We're in the channel Tech Bytes, irc.cuckoo.com, or if you don't want to use your own IRC client, come on in via the web at geekradio.com. Use the Java client. You can hang out with us. It's the show within a show, as we like to call it. And the phone number, which you should not call because Groove House is not here to answer it, but 713-526-5738. We'll be taking calls a little bit later in the show. And what?
I thought all the callers were listening to you and saying, oh, okay, Groove House isn't going to be here to pick up the phone, so we'll just hang up politely. But no, it was Flicked in there wielding the finger of death, clearing the lines.
Yeah, there were two lines that said on air, so I just hung them up.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the phones aren't up, so they wouldn't go on the air, but it said on air on the phone screen.
All right. So I think we've dragged our feet as long as we can here. What we're going to do is go out to San Antonio for the Technology Bytes Info Shot, the news segment of our program. Live from San Antonio, it's Peter Hughes.
It's the Technology Bytes Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Okay, well, everybody knows what the most enormous story of today was, and obviously it had everything to do with iPad, and of course, we will get to that. I'll put that to the end. We'll cover some other things, and then that's sort of what's new is all the new stuff from Apple. Top thing, this was an interesting one. The FBI turned the head of LulzSec and sicked him on, made him inform on Anonymous, and Anonymous is not amused. He's Sabu, S-A-B-U, was part of LulzSec, a potent offshoot of Anonymous. He masterminded legendary attacks against the CIA, FBI, Sony, and numerous other corporate and government targets. But not anymore. He's been confirmed to be unemployed, 28-year-old New Yorker Hector Javier Monsegur, but Sabu has been, quote, collaborating with the government for months, unquote, leading to a string of arrests around the world today. It's not clear how many people will be dragged down with Sabu's 9 months of federal collaborating, but it's safe to assume that whatever vestiges of LulzSec remained are toast. Of course, it'll be clear when all the indictments are unsealed. According to Fox News, the dragnet was thick. Last year in mid-August, he pleaded guilty to more than 10 charges relating to hacking activity. In the following few weeks, he worked almost daily out of FBI offices, helping the feds identify and ultimately take down the other high-level members of LulzSec and Anonymous. The way they turned him apparently was because of his kids. He didn't want to go away to prison and leave his children. And according to the FBI, quote, that's how we got him. Apparently, there were people who were suspicious that he was a snitch, and Gizmodo has an interesting article on it. It's not worth covering here, but where the guy said that around August he started getting requests from Sabu to do some stuff, and that he was suspicious and wouldn't do them, and so apparently has remained out of the dragnet. The Lulzsec proper has been dormant since last summer. Sabu has remained a hugely influential character atop a vast cult of personality. The revelation that he sought the movement he professed to love so much will deal as much a psychological as logistical blow to Anonymous. After all, the guy tweeted this only yesterday, quote, "The federal government is run by a bunch of blanking cowards. Don't give in to these people. Fight back. Stay strong." It's like, oops. according to Gizmodo, whatever you say, Hector. And in other, you know, now, so law enforcement's really got their act together and is keeping things straight. You may have heard about this one, but the Montgomery County Sheriff's Department was proud of their of being the first department in the country to have their own aerial drone, $300,000 aerial drone, and they were set up for a really nice photo op with it. So they had the SWAT team was out there, suited up with lots of firepower in their armored vehicle known as the Bearcat. And so the SWAT team was there with that, and then the prototype drone from Vanguard Defense Industries took off for pictures of all the police action. It was basically a photo opportunity. So they launched the drone, and it was flying about 18 feet off the ground when it lost contact with the controller's console on the ground. It's designed to go into an auto shutdown mode, but when it was coming down, the drone crashed into the SWAT team's armored vehicle. All right, so photo opportunity, $300,000 drone showing off for the press, and crash into the SWAT team. Luckily, the SWAT boys were safe in their Bearcat, so clearly the safest place to hide out from a drone in Montgomery County is inside the SWAT vehicle. you've got to wonder what the story, you know, this is maybe an indication that are drones really ready for prime time for local law enforcement? Obviously the odds of being hit by one are low, but imagine over a more densely populated area, that would not be pleasant. Cause it's not small. It's not like some sort of little tiny thing. So anyways, just a little local technology story. Clearly, you know, while they can control drones from Las Vegas that are flying in Afghanistan, apparently they can't control them across a field in Montgomery County. So what does that says something about something. I don't know what. Here's a good one for the future. Fiber optics obviously are the sort of future of high-speed data transfer, but in Germany, the future has arrived. Deutsche Telekom has a working 512 gigabit per second optical fiber that's working in the real world. Yes. Yeah, it's a single optical fiber capable of hitting transmission speeds of 512 gigs per second in test conditions, but real life takes that down to a usable limit of only of a pathetic 400 gigabits per second. No matter when a single strand of optical fiber can stream what is the same as 350,000 CDs of music being played at the same time, that's kind of hard to complain too much. And the best part is it's not laboratory stuff. They didn't just do this in a lab. This is being used over a 500-mile stretch between Berlin and Hanover alongside the company's usual 10 gigabit per second line. So you think about that. When you replace it, you replace the one line, one single fiber will basically give them 40 times the bandwidth along that stretch. Deutsche Telekom explains that if they rolled this out using their usual 48-channel optical fibers, they could achieve a throughput. Now, this is replacing that 10 gigabit per second line, a throughput 24.6 terabits per second on a cable thinner than a human hair. You know, I'm ready for that. I'm ready for them to run that to our house. Of course, you know, they're in Europe, they already do better and faster than what we've got because obviously Europe is a lot smaller, each country, than us. So don't hold your breath waiting for the 512 gigabit per second fiber optic to show up. Another thing where you may not want to hold your breath is the whole TV everywhere. You know, Time Warner and Comcast have the stuff where you can see TV shows online and that. And there's been some things that have happened with it, but it's not quite, you know, if you've ever looked at it, it's not quite what you'd expect. So the question comes up, what went wrong? The Wall Street Journal reports that the problem is the slow, tedious negotiations, along with a changing model of interaction between channels, cable providers, and media consumers. Quote, apps give networks the opportunity to be in direct contact with consumers, sometimes for the first time, which allows the networks to collect email addresses and other info about their viewers directly, and it could eventually make it easier for channels to compete with the cable operators or survive without them. That potential for conflict has bogged down TV Everywhere's rollout as cable operators and TV channels wrangle over whose websites and application subscribers what applications subscribers can use to watch shows online. For instance, News Corp, that's Fox, and Disney have so far insisted that they will include shows from their broadcast networks and TV Everywhere only if subscribers also can watch them through their joint venture online video site, Hulu. Hulu and other services, however, seem to be feared among cable companies because they're concerned about the competition. Obviously, based on the number of people we've heard talking about, you know, cutting the cable and going to Hulu and Roku and so on, I think maybe they might have a point there. But that fear leads to more blocked content, less openness, and ultimately inferior service for consumers. So it's getting to be about time for all these different groups to work it out so they don't get passed by. And now the part that I'm sure all of you have been desperately waiting for. Of course, the ones who are desperately waiting for it already probably sat through the keynote and watched this stuff revealed in real time. But if you're wanting the quick and dirty summary, Apple announced several things. They announced the next generation iPad. And there's a sort of change with it on the name. They kept referring to it as the new iPad. At a certain point during the rollout thing, I actually was sort of scrolling through the feeds looking to see what had they really called it. And apparently it's just the iPad. The third generation. So, you know, there's a bunch of people sort of making fun of that, except that's, you know, look around at Apple's product line. You know, you've got the PowerBook, the Power Mac, you've got the iMac, you've got the iPod Touch. They don't name them differently for each generation after a certain point. So I'm kind of not surprised they did it. Of course, the problem gets into is anybody who, say, maybe wanted to order RAM for their iMac, you have to either go in and look up which model it is with the longer kind of unsexy model number thing for it, or remember what year you bought it or what year the one you bought was released so that you can choose the right RAM or the right other things to add to it. You know, is that better or worse? I don't know. But on the plus side, all the rumors, all the big deal things about this seem to have come through. It does have a Retina display. It's a 9.7-inch screen that plays host to 3.1 million pixels. That's 2048 by 1536. 264 pixels per inch. So what you're talking about is a resolution that's closer to like the 300 dpi, you know, dots per inch printing that we used to have from that we got from laser printers back in the day. So you're getting very close to that kind of paper resolution. That screen is a million more pixels than your high-definition television at home. Your 1080p television has a million fewer pixels than the new iPad. It also apparently has improved color saturation And they updated some other things. It has an A5X processor and quad-core graphics chip. Apple even claims its newest sliver of silicon, excuse me, can deliver four times the performance of a Tegra 3. So that's interesting. New EyeSight camera on board that's quite similar to the one inside the iPhone 4S. It's only 5 megapixels, but it does have a backside illuminated sensor with a 5-element lens. Can capture 1080p video. That shouldn't be a big surprise. On the keyboard, you know, that when you click the button to have the screen keyboard show up, there's a new key there that you can click that's a sort of lowball version of Siri that lets you speak instead of type. So you can dictate to your the new iPad, which you couldn't do that before. Also, you can use it as a portable Wi-Fi hotspot as long as your carrier allows it. It even has the ability to recognize at least some bezel gestures. In other words, touching the outside of the screen as revealed during the iPhoto demo. Most exciting is how it connects up to the internet. It's using LTE. The new iPad is sporting 21 megabit per second HSPA Plus, which I think is the AT&T 4th gen. But it's also rocking an LTE radio capable of pulling down apparently 73 megabits per second on both Verizon and AT&T in the U.S. Outside of the States, Rogers, Bell, and Telus will also be scoring 4G flavors of the iOS tablet. Even with an LTE antenna on board, though, Apple is claiming to get 10 hours of battery life, the same battery life as before. You know, one of the big problems of 4G, and we've talked about before, especially for phones, is that it can kill battery life to use it. And Apple claims that the battery life is unchanged. There's a slight increase in weight to 1.4 pounds, so that's probably all battery. But what does all this cost? So they did the awesome screen, they did they've increased the processor, they've got all this, all these new features. The prices are unchanged. New iPad will be available a week from this Friday, March 16th, so at the end of many people's spring break, the last Friday of many people's spring breaks, or I guess the first Friday of some, the Friday they get off for their spring break if it's later, starting at around $500 for the 16 gig Wi-Fi model and going up to $829 for the 64 gig with the 4G in it. So nothing changed there. The other thing they did, the iPad 2 isn't going to go away. The iPad 2 is going to become the next step down, the getting a cheaper price. They lowered the price of the 16 gig iPad to $399, and then the 3G model. Obviously, it didn't add 4G to the iPad 3. The 3G model of the iPad 2 is going to be $530. So you can make a real there's a real choice there. If the iPad 2 stuff doesn't matter, or if you're on a limited budget, it still gives you that opportunity. Of course, in the near term, if you're looking for an iPad 2, you could probably buy one from somebody who hasn't had it for all that long and have a lot more memory in it for a pretty low price. I think if you look around, there are going to be people who want to get out from under their iPad 2, and you can probably pick one up for a pretty decent price, although people are proud of them when they sell them. The 4G plans are are going to sound fairly familiar. The pricing, I don't think, has been that different. AT&T has their cheapest plan is 250 megabytes per month, which at 4G speeds wouldn't take you that long to saturate. That's $15 a month. Then they have a 2 gig plan that's $30 and a 5 gig plan that's $50. And then Verizon, basically, they have a higher top end plan, and they dropped the cheapo plan. They do the 2 gigs a month for $30, 5 gigs for $50, and 10 gigs per month for $80. Which, you know, at a certain point, you kind of go, geez, I can get a lot more bandwidth than that on my my home cable hookup, and that's only like $40 or $50. So hopefully at some point there will be some competition pressure that will help pull down the price on that. The other thing that Apple announced, and the final news item for tonight, they didn't announce an Apple television, but they did announce a new Apple TV. And so it has some slight spec bumps. The biggest thing is it's a lot more integrated with Netflix than it was. It'll do 1080p streams, which before it maxed out at 720p. So this will let you take full advantage of downloading movies from Netflix that are the full high-def experience. As far as the price, just like before, it basically, just like the iPad, the price hasn't changed. It's still $100 for the box. And it has a new interface, and, you know, it'll do the, you know, where you can download, you can access your music that's on, you know, local machines that have iTunes and movies that are on iTunes. And you can, you know, order movies and buy them from your iTunes account and play them on your Apple TV. So all in all, a pretty good day for Apple announcing stuff. And that's part of why if you were, say, looking for news stories for a radio show, you didn't find a whole lot of hardware and software announcements from anybody else that came out today. They all just bailed on it and left this day to Apple, to their announcements. And that's the news.
All right. And we have found Groovehouse.
He was already camping out at the soon-to-open Apple store to get his iPad 3.
Yep. I was in line. I got it.
He wore himself out crashing the Apple server. He's the real Sabu.
Yeah.
So what happened, Groovehouse? Share with us a little insight into the Groovehouse mind.
I was asleep.
Five more minutes, Jay.
Yeah, I didn't even hear my alarm go off. I didn't wake up until Flick had called me.
Wow.
About 8:05.
Yeah, if it had been any longer, we were going to put Flicted's mom on your trail.
Yeah, it was weird. We actually, everything else went without a hitch. We got Pete
right, I wasn't
right,
in my
right
spot
at the intro, and it was and he's Groovehouse. And he's
not here.
Groovehouse.
He's not sleeping. Here. He was asleep.
Oh, well, we're glad you're here.
Tucked under the blankets.
Oh, the weather's kind of getting a little cool and windy and rain. I love rain.
Cat was sleeping all up next to me. And then I was rudely awake.
Man, I want to nap now.
You could just play some music and I'll go to sleep.
It's so good.
Yeah, I'll have the Afflicted. I'll do his new music show. Or something.
Yeah, the new music show by Afflicted.
All right, well, 713-526-5738 is the number to call if you would like to be on the air with us tonight. Groovehouse will do the best he can. If the phone sounds too much like his alarm clock, he probably won't answer it.
So did anybody besides me
buy an iPad?
Lots of people. New iPad?
Lots of people did. Or
nobody.
Tried to.
You're the only one.
I got close.
I felt like I was the only one. Trying to get in was so damn hard.
Mm-hmm.
It was really tough.
I was going to impulse buy one, and it failed, and I'm glad it did.
So, it cut short your impulse, huh?
Yeah. It was like, you know, it was like reaching for the Hostess Ding Dong on the end cap, only to find out it's been glued to the shelf.
Oh.
Yeah. Or they keep moving it. Like, I'm not going to go to a different store is kind of what it felt like. I mean, I waited probably for half an hour at that last screen and just couldn't get through.
Huh.
I gave up. That was kind of early on. If I had waited until this evening, maybe it would have changed.
I wanted to have one on day one because I want to review it. There's no guarantee Apple will send me one to review for day one. And so, and plus I wanted the better screen and the LTE.
And you have a first-gen iPad, right?
Yeah, I mean, for Dwight, so the upgrade is totally worth it.
Right.
Right. White or black?
Part of the upgrade
white,
cycle.
16 gig, Verizon.
4G. That part just, I'm surprised, first of all, that you got the low end, you know, the kind of the low end. It's not the Wi-Fi only, but the smaller drive space. I was surprised by, but you explained your reasons for that. But the Verizon part of it.
I want, I'm thinking about switching to Verizon when the iPhone 5 or just iPhone, if that's what they call it, when it comes out this year. And just because I'm kind of disgusted with it, some of AT&T's practices. And although AT&T's LTE network is a thing of wonder. It's Which faster than Verizon's. AT&T's
LTE. Verizon's built out in more cities, though, aren't they?
Right. As far as and see, the reason I wanted a 4G one, the iPad I have now is Wi-Fi only. The reason I wanted a 4G one is for travel. And so if I'm going to use LTE, I want to have it in whatever city I'm in. Verizon at the moment has the greater spread.
Domestic travel.
Right. Now,
they're more forgiving on the whole. They're more likely to let you use it to as a hotspot too, right?
Yes. Well, it's the
does the iPad have hotspot capability?
This version will let you do a hotspot. They said if the carrier allows it, is the way it was put in during the announcement today. So we'll see if that happens with Verizon. That's not a high priority for me, but. I do want to just have connectivity wherever I am, and so you know, I probably in town won't ever like pay for, you know, it's you don't get a contract, just you pay for it as you need it, and I probably won't use it in town, but because there's plenty of Wi-Fi where I usually am.
When you need it though, it's there.
Right.
Which means, why white over the black bezel? I was kind of struggling with that. I thought the white looked better on the screen,
I have a white iPad, and it. It looks better.
Yeah. That's what I think.
It's not that it looks better, like it's aesthetically pleasing. The white is nicer color, but the screen is not hard edged. So when you're looking at it, everything kind of fades to white instead of like you know locks in this black border. So
I may also get a white iPhone 5, presuming they're available in white. Who knows? You know, we may see the return of that "She Comes in Colors Everywhere" commercial that they did for the first IMAX.
I'm thinking that Apple ought to just have a big announcement of their new Apple Store 2 or something, you know, with improved ability to actually buy products.
That's what they need. They need to update it.
What was the photo announcement regarding Apple?
iPhoto. They have a version of iPhoto now for the iPad, and it looks really good from the way it was described on the in the video and kind of the features. It's not just like we can tweak your photo. It's a serious photo editor. So
also the journaling type stuff. Where it'll save the GPS coordinates where you took the picture and what weather it'll show the weather for the date and time when you did it.
Yeah, it looks pretty good. And it's $4.99.
I don't see taking photos and moving them to the iPad for processing. I see taking photos with the iPad and processing those photos.
Right, and this has a much better camera. It's a 5-megapixel camera with IR filtering and image stabilization, 1080p video. So you know,
is the camera on par? Is it the same camera as the iPhone 4S?
Yes.
So you can make great Instagram photos.
So you can Instagram the hell out of that thing.
Exactly.
Did you hear about the guy who Instagrammed the baseball spring training New York Yankees photos?
No.
He took a whole series of team photos with the iPhone. Instagram. Hipster photos.
La-dee-da.
La-dee-da.
Did you see the wedding that was completely captured on an iPhone?
No.
And it looked pretty good. Video and stills, all iPhone photos and iPhone video. Well, Groovehouse and I are actually experiencing new tech joy, aren't we?
Are we?
Yeah. Oh. Lightroom 4.
Yes.
I've got my copy. I haven't got it installed yet.
I installed mine yesterday. But I didn't use it until today.
What I'm really interested in is the native support for the video that my camera will shoot, so I'll be able to edit videos.
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, enhance.
I want to try the barrel distortion thing.
Oh, the lens correction?
Yeah, lens correction.
Yeah. And there's a little bit of that in the profiles in Lightroom 3, I think. But is there something newer? Is it? I haven't really looked at it.
Apparently they've upgraded it or something.
What I saw what I heard that's in there that sounds, you'll get off a little photo geek while we're waiting for the phone. They have one of the brush tools is for white balance. So you can actually correct white balance in parts of the photo instead of necessarily for the whole photo. So that might be something interesting to do if you've got colored lights on a subject and you want to keep that subject the proper colors. So, yeah, it looks real interesting. And they dropped the price by 50%.
Really? On Lightroom?
On Lightroom, yeah.
That's impressive.
From $350 down to $300 to $150.
That's impressive.
Yeah. And the upgrades are not terribly expensive.
This is an Adobe product.
It's an Adobe product, I know. It was shocking.
Do you think enough people are getting into digital photography to where they're selling enough units to be able to drop the price?
It might be something where they want to get more into the consumer market and not people that are, just using something to process. Because so many people have digital cameras. It's not like it's not like Photoshop, I guess, where you got to really be a pro. Lightroom is a really good. It's not ultra user friendly, I suppose, but it's user friendly enough. So we were talking about the price drop. They dropped the price from $300 to $150.
Yeah, and upgrade $79.
Right.
So someone could conceivably, with no real experience touching up photos, come in, be up and going within a day or two, or within afternoon. You
I'm
think?
Sure with sure. the basics. Yeah, the standard stuff. Yeah, and the thing is that I've been telling a lot of people that are into photography and need a processing and a cataloging tool to download the trial. But the problem, at $300 a pop, you download the trial and you go, well, that was nice, but I can't afford it. But now $150, that's, when you're talking, if you're serious into photography, that's not the cost of a new lens. It's not the cost of a new camera body. $300, you're starting to get into maybe a new 50mm or something, but your commitment to the craft, it's a good tool.
It puts you at the step up from some of the cheaper kind of light photo.
Yeah, I mean,
stuff.
Picnic online is going away, has gone away.
Yeah.
And your choices are limited, getting to be more and more limited.
I mean, there's definitely some good free tools out there that will do good work. But if you're seriously wanting to try to, maximize your photography and get the most out of a photo you've taken, I was just using Lightroom the other day to my wife had taken a bunch of pictures back in 2009 in Spain when we went to Las Fallas, and I was just noticing that they were a little washed out and a little underexposed, and we wanted to print some out for the scrapbook. And so I went through in Lightroom, and just the amount of life I was able to breathe into these photos. I mean, the subject matter was great, the composition was great, but the camera was just underexposing everything and was able to bring that out.
Oh, yeah. I've saved many a photo that I thought was bad or going to be thrown away just by tweaking it in Lightroom and brought it back to life.
713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with Technology Bites. It looks like we do have a call in the queue. So we'll take that call, but we'll encourage you to dial in if you want to be on the air with us. All the other lines are open at this time. Groovehouse is starting to stumble into consciousness.
Yeah.
And he might be able to handle screening a call or two.
I'm
so 713-526-5738.
Stretch it out a little bit. Yeah, we're ready.
Gonna fly now.
Let's do this.
All right, Groovehouse, who's up?
All right, up first on the show, the Sleepy Show, it's going to be Jeff.
Jeff, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hi, everybody. I need a recommendation on a good disk wipe utility. I use something called Darren's Bootnuke.
Darren's Bootnuke, yeah.
That's a good one.
But
that's
a good
one.
I can't get it to work on this laptop. It just doesn't want to seem to read the hard drive. There's nothing wrong with the hard drive as far as I'm concerned. The computer boots up fine. I just have done too many restores on it, and I'd just like to start clean.
Well, let me ask you this. When you're using the Bootnuke program, have you ever used it before?
Yeah, I used it on another drive just days before that. It worked just fine.
Now, you're booting up from the disk that you're creating?
That's correct.
And does it boot up?
It boots up.
And it loads up what does it say?
It says registering USB devices. It goes through that. When it's done, it puts up a little message, PCI, and in parentheses it says like Sisyphus or something like that, and then it just locks up.
Do you know on the system you're trying to use it on, is that have a RAID controller on it by chance?
No, it's not a RAID controller. It's just this regular old Lenovo laptop.
Okay.
Is the drive encrypted?
No.
I don't think that would matter because BootNIC just looks at the device and writes to it or wipes it. It's not overly complex.
I mean, it just doesn't seem to see the hard drive at all. So then I was wondering, if I should try something else. If there's a disk wipe utility, I can just put it like on a flash drive that I don't have to burn from an ISO image.
Well, you know, if you can get a... you need to be able to boot the system. To do the most effective wipe, you boot the system up with something that, you know, bypasses the operating system on the hard drive and allows you direct access to the drive to wipe the data.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah. I don't have any problem getting a choice of device to boot from.
Right. Well, one of the best things in the world you can do to wipe a system is to take the recovery disks that you made when you bought the computer and reload the system back to factory fresh, and it wipes. It just basically overwrites all of your data.
I don't think it's doing that. I've done this. I've used this set of restore disks previously on some other drives,
uh-huh.
And it seems to work all right. But in this case, it didn't really work right the last time.
Well, instead
of asking for the whole set of discs, it quit after my son did it, and it said that it had, you know, did it use all the discs? And he said no, and it just didn't seem to be right. So I thought if I wiped the drive and started from scratch, I might have a better chance of getting it restored.
Well, you can always try if you can boot up and get some access to a format command.
Well, but it always seems to be files locked. I can't seem to...
The files are only going to be locked if the operating system itself boots up. You have to boot up and bypass the operating system. Now, I have not used BootNIC in a long time. Are you actually booting up the BootNIC disk, or are you trying to run that program inside a Windows?
I think he's running it. Do you have a card reader installed or any USB devices plugged into the machine?
No.
A lot of people are getting those errors. It more or less it goes for waiting for USB devices to register done, and then it does the PCI sys and just hangs. If you go into BIOS and just disable any kind of USB you might have, it should get all the way through there.
Okay, I'll try.
If you don't want to burn new disks, and if you know how to use DBAN and everything like that, just go disable your USB stuff, and that PCI sys isn't going to hang anymore.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll give that a whirl.
Another thing you could try is, maybe get some other live CD from a Linux operating system or Ubuntu or something like that and use that to repartition the drive.
I'm not that smart.
So if you can get into the BIOS, just disable the USB just for a boot and try that out. See what it does.
I'll give it a whirl.
All right, good luck.
Thanks.
I actually used on my netbook, which didn't have a CD drive, I had to wipe the drive before I sold it. And I can't remember the name of it, but I found a program that will actually do it from within Windows. You actually run this executable, and it wipes the drive, reboots, and then it's gone.
I would just use the Windows boot utility, blow away the partition, and then just reinstall Windows fresh and just start from that. You know, I think he's seeing things that aren't there. He's seeing strange things under the bed that aren't really
there. There's no real reason to wipe a drive unless you're going to throw it away without destroying it.
Or give it away.
I mean, but the thing is, if it's going to leave your possession, if he's doing it for his own PC, if you're going to be using it, it's fine.
Right.
It's not going to, you're not like inheriting ghosts of bad operating systems past or anything like that.
Right. All right, 713-526-5738 is the number to call if you want to be on the air with us tonight. Groovehouse?
Yes.
Who's up next?
All right, up next, we're going to take Alan.
Alan, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Thank you. I have the same problem, a similar problem. I have a Acer laptop that my friend wants to give away, so I volunteered to wipe it clean, thinking I could do it. So I bought some software. And I read the book, and it calculated that I could do this 70-time write-over, and, you know, there'd be nothing left. But it could take 4 or 5 days, and I only had a day or two. So I tried the most severe wipe, and calculated that would take about 20 hours. And so I started that, and it immediately said, you'll be done in 2 hours. So I thought, well, if that's only 2 hours instead of 20, maybe I can get this big wipe done in 10 hours, you know. So I press cancel and try to reinitiate the process, and it essentially is said, you've wiped it clean. There's nothing there. The software doesn't work. Their restore disk doesn't work. And my friend never kept the restore disks from the original purchase. Is there anything I can do?
I'm guessing that was there a restore partition there? Did you check to see if there was one there before you wiped the drive?
No.
That's probably where the CD was, or where the software was to actually be able to restore the netbook.
Yes. So is there anything? I mean, nothing's been physically damaged.
What is it you're trying to do at this point?
Restore it.
Well, I want to give it. We want to wipe it so she can give it away to a family member.
When you say wipe it, if you wipe it and you erase all the data and you give it to a family member, they're going to get a computer that has no software on it.
Right. And it didn't have much on it to begin with. But
I mean, it's going to have no software on it. Like, they're going to have to figure out a way
to get it up. Like, it's not going to be able to boot into
OS. It won't boot. It'll hang up and say error non-system disk.
They're going to have to find a way to load an operating system on it.
Okay, how can I? I'll do that for them.
You need the restore CD.
All right, well, you say it's an Acer?
Yes.
Well, you can try contacting Acer. Is it a netbook or a laptop?
Laptop, I don't know.
Does it have a CD drive or no?
Yes, it has a CD drive.
Oh, it's a laptop then. All right, so you can get a copy, a licensed copy of any Windows operating system of your choice.
Mm-hmm.
Probably XP would be a good one to consider, depending on the capabilities of the computer.
XP sounds right.
You can boot up with the XP disk. It'll look at the disk. It'll say, do you want to, you know, replace what's there? Do you want to fix what's there? So you can boot it up with that CD and then install the operating system. And one of the options in the install is to just blow away what's there and put a new operating system on it.
So I can do that. I can buy an XP, and I agree with the recommendation.
Although I got to tell you, it's getting harder and harder to find XP, at least at retail.
It's hard to find. If you look hard enough, and you have to be careful, because a lot of people are selling OEM discs, but they're specific to a manufacturer.
I know,
so like Dell, you can find Dell OEM CDs all day long, but they'll only load on a Dell.
Unless this has like a gig or less of memory and a really small hard drive, I would recommend using Windows 7 on that machine.
Really?
Yeah.
You could, if you want to, you can actually go to Acer.com, and if you type in the serial number on the Acer laptop on the bottom of it there, it'll actually let you order e-recovery CDs online. And by e-recovery CDs, I'm hoping it's like a download that you can
download
burn out
the
and
ISO,
just go.
Right.
So I get you up and going right now. As long as you know that sticker, the serial number hasn't been peeled off.
No, it hasn't. And I've been calling the wiping software people and complaining, and I literally waited for an hour and 45 minutes on hold.
Which software was that?
It's called Driver Race Pro. And when I finally got to mine, I said, there's a problem with our system. You've been cut off. Call back later. So I finally called them back, left it, and they called me back and said, we can't help you. We'll try to get a smarter person to help you. And they blew me off, so I gave up. I never thought of contacting Acer.
Well, just don't even contact them. Go to support.
.acer.com,
and then under the accessory store, there's a section that's e-recovery CDs. Do that, put in the serial number, and you should be able to do it with the credit card. It might even be free. I can't get that far because I don't have a valid, you know, serial number.
I can do that. Okay,
it looks like they make it easy for you.
Good. Thanks a lot.
All right, good luck. Thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Right. So it's wipe your hard drive night here on Technology.
Yeah, no one do that. There's no reason. I think when I was super paranoid, I think it's a cool thing to do, and it's a nice spy kind of thing. But, I mean, just take a hammer to it. If you're going to trash it, if you're going to give it away, then maybe, but still.
Yeah, if the drive is going to go in the trash or go to the recycler, take a hammer to it. That's very satisfying. Just extremely satisfying. Nobody's going to get anything.
And also sort of think about what is it, is what's on there that you are really afraid that could be possibly recovered? Because it's not, you know, if you're going to give it to a relative, then I would think deleting the documents, you know, deleting your tax returns or whatever off of it, or just, you know, reinstalling the operating system so that it's just a fresh, clean install is pretty much going to be enough.
And the people that have the technology to go in and inspect the drive and see what was on it two passes ago or three passes ago for the Uber Paranoid, those people have big budgets, and it's a lot cheaper to go for your kneecaps than it is to, you know, go repair a drive like that. A black vinyl port, and you'll just disappear
Now, yeah, if it's something that those people are going to be looking for, then you probably don't want to be giving your computer to somebody else. You just want to get a drive out and destroy it.
Well, to play devil's advocate, I don't want to discourage people from at least thinking about protecting their data and keeping themselves secure. I mean, there's a lot of people throw computers into the landfill or give them away or send them to recyclers or resellers without any thought whatsoever of the fact that there is data on that drive that somebody may be interested in. If you do TurboTax or you keep an Excel spreadsheet with all your account numbers in it or something like that, somebody might, you know, dig around and find that. So you definitely want to go through and delete those files. I think one of the problems that people encounter is that they don't necessarily know where to look for all those files. They don't, you want to make sure, how do I know? They don't know their own file system well enough to know that they've got rid of everything that they need to get rid of. I did find a program. It's called Eraser. And you have to do Eraser, E-R-A-S-E-R, Eraser Wipe as your Google search, and you'll find this. And it's a program that you can actually run inside of Windows, which will let you wipe the drive, do selective data deletes, and so forth like that. And I don't know how much it costs, but it looks like I was reading some of the forums, and they talked about it being a good program. So that might be something you want to look at if you have a computer that will boot into Windows. All right, 713-526-5738. But, yeah, I agree. People that get a little freaked out and want to write a bunch of zeros and do those, like, you know.
Takes forever.
One pass is fine. I mean, JJ definitely has a point. Like, definitely do something to obscure it. But there's a difference between putting, like, a deadbolt on your front door and, like, 50 chain locks. You know, it's a little overkill. Yeah, or welding it shut, you know.
I'm safe, but I can't get out.
I can't breathe.
Not for the next 80 hours while this format, happens.
Yeah. You know, and another thing is if you're really fighting it that hard and it's taking that long, you know, you could probably buy a used hard drive somewhere and just replace the hard drive and trash that one.
If you can make a dollar an hour right there, you just bought yourself a new drive at 80 hours.
All right. Groove House?
Yes.
More disc stuff. All right, cool. Who's up next?
All right, up next, we're going to take Jason.
Jason, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
How you guys doing?
Good.
My wife has a Dell that's just a few years old, and I found a corrupted file, just one of the picture files that I had taken, and it just, you know, when I try to open it, it says it's corrupted.
Uh-huh.
And it suggests to do, Windows has a disk fix or something like that.
So there's a check disk, and which version of Windows?
It's 7.
7, okay, yeah, Windows 7 has a disk utility.
Yep, and it takes me through that and says, would you like to set up for the next boot this disk check?
Uh-huh.
And I've learned that, you know, once it does that, then you can then delete that file, but I say, yes, I'd like to do that, and on the next reboot, and then it doesn't do it on the next reboot. And so I'm wondering what suggestions you have.
Well, when I run a check disk the way I do it, I'm sure this works in Windows 7. It worked in XP, but you open up a command prompt. You type chkdsk space /F. It'll come back and say the disk is in use. Do you want to schedule this to happen on your next reboot? You answer yes to that. Then you shut it down. You restart it, and it should load into this disk utility that says, you know, if you don't want to run this, press any key, and it will bypass it. But so you don't want to press that key, you want to let it run through, but you're not seeing that at all?
No, sir. No.
And it
normally boots up and everybody, you know, everybody's happy other than I can't run a disk check, and then because I can't do that, I can't do a system restore if I ever needed to.
Are you sure that it's not running the disk check so fast you're just missing it?
Oh, I never thought about that.
Do you watch the reboot happen? Or do you go away and come back and see what it's done?
I do watch the reboot happen, and everything seems to be normal.
Okay, because I know that some people will reboot a computer and they'll just walk away, and if the check disk goes without a hitch, sometimes it can go by really fast.
The other thing you might try doing is doing the F8 key thing so that you you interrupt it.
Right.
And then start it from
Safe mode
at a command prompt and run check disk from there.
Ah, okay, run it in safe mode. Okay.
Add a command prompt. Not just safe mode, but safe mode and a command prompt. That'll bypass the loading of the GUI and just boot up the operating system real basic. and you should be able to run a check disk from there because you don't have open file handles from Windows having all your files open.
Okay, and that check disk, and I'm seeing there, that looks like it's a pretty simple, I can look Google that real quick, it's that check disk exe file. Or that you were giving me, it was check disk.
CHKDSK.
Slash. Do you have to do the slash F if you're...
If you're doing it from a command prompt, you still have to do it as an F. If you do it just in CHKDSK and hit enter, it'll check for errors, but it won't fix anything.
Okay.
And a command prompt and say...
Slash F.
Huh?
Backslash or slash F?
Slash that starts at the left and goes up to the right.
Forward slash.
Forward slash.
That's what we call marine proof. That almost explains it, so we can't screw it up.
Right. Well, you know, I've had people that don't know the difference. So
I appreciate it. But I appreciate your suggestions.
Let me say one thing before you go. One thing I seem to recall when you're running check disk from a command prompt is the command may not be slash F. It may be slash P.
Okay.
But if you do a CHKDSK space forward slash question mark, it'll tell you, or help, it'll tell you what all these switches options are for what it'll do.
Sounds good.
All right.
Or let you know, too, that every time I send my money in, I always cite you guys. You're probably the reason I send my money in. So,
man, that's the best dollar you ever spent.
It's not much. Cheap entertainment. So it's all good,
we're cheap entertainers. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, guys.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right, I got to make sure I have both earphones in because I'm sure I already missed it.
No, I thought about doing it, but I didn't because I decided the call would end in enough time that we'd be good.
All right, yeah, well, we only have about 3.5 minutes before the top of the hour, so what do you think we should do?
We got one and a half minutes left.
Oh, that's right, because we did it at 58.
Yeah.
All right, yeah, well, we're coming up to the top of the hour break here on Technology Bites, which is just a minute and a half or less. Now less, even less now.
I was
going to
say, y'all invoked my mother, and so she texted. she texted me, and...
The bloody hook?
Are you awake?
She said, tell them your mom was ready to be called into active duty.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's awesome.
She listens in a cat-like state of readiness.
Yes.
She knows what we've done.
Her drone never crashes.
Well, we're so glad we got Flicked's mom, you know, in the Technology Bites arsenal. And, you know, Groovehouse, that would have been great if we had Groovehouse's address and could have sent her over there.
Knocked on the door.
Dispatch the mom.
Launch mom. Fire Flicked mom. Yeah, that would have been awesome. All right, yeah, Groovehouse, let's move along.
I don't think he's going to be ever sleeping again.
25 seconds.
Yeah, I got a clock and I figured out how to read it in here. So, yeah, we actually got a compliment for being able to stop the show and adhere to the breaks the best we could. All right, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And he's
Awake
here.
In Groovehouse.
KPFT is supported in part by Americans United for Separation of Church and State, which is featuring a screening of the film The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today at Rice University Media Center on March the 17th at 7 p.m. This documentary shows one mother's efforts to ensure that her son is not discriminated in school because of his lack of religious beliefs. Also speaking will be Jim McConnell, the son to whom this case went all the way to the Supreme Court. Go to auhouston.org or email AmericansUnited@HoustonChapter@gmail.com for more information.
Don't think you can make a difference? Be part of a movement that can revolutionize the radio station you know and love. By joining KPFT's Sustainer program, you can support your station and help KPFT reduce its pledge drives. What's a sustainer? Rather than giving a yearly gift, sustainers give a monthly donation that continues as long as you want. Giving $20, $100, or $500 monthly helps change the way KPFT operates. From having to meet our operating expenses through days and days of on-air fundraising, to friends of the station boosting it off-air throughout the fiscal year. Contact our development director at 713-526-4000 to inquire about our sustainer program. Did you know sustainers can ultimately give a gift that is substantially larger than annual givers? That means less pledge drive, more efficiency, and greater stability for KPFT, regardless of the time of year. Again, just call our development director at 713-526-4000 to inquire about our sustainer program. Make a difference today. This is KPFT Houston.
Thank you.
You listen to KPFT, you enjoy some of our fine programming, and you have done your part to keep us commercial-free by calling in a pledge of support. Hats off to you for taking that first step. But before you settle into that fantastic feeling, don't forget, you still need to send in that pledge of support to finalize your promise to KPFT. But be warned, that fantastic feeling will soon follow. Thanks for supporting KPFT Houston.
Hey, Barrett, what's happening?
I don't know.
Well, room around town.
We interrupt this skit to bring you...
Yeah. That means it's time for...
Barrett time!
Yeah. Anyway. Take it away, Barrett.
All right. The new iPad 3 went on sale today for a March 16th delivery date. That's all. Actually, that's really all I've got. Unless we talk about the weather. I think it's supposed to rain tomorrow. And, oh yeah, the sun let loose an intense solar flare at 6:28 Texas time yesterday from sunspot 1429. The coronal mass ejection is now traveling through space and will deliver a glancing blow to Earth in the morning hours of Thursday, March 8th. That's tomorrow morning. The coronal mass ejection, or CME, will yield a strong magnetic storm that has the potential to trip electrical power grids and disrupt global positioning systems, making them much less accurate. Additionally, all flights over the North and South Poles will be rerouted due to communication problems caused by radiation from the ongoing solar storm. Yay. Sadly, the forecast for Android tablets is just about as spotty. I probably just should have stuck to the iPad announcement. But that's it for your 30 more seconds of iPad, and that's that for Barrett time. I dialed it in. I didn't have very much. But the solar storm is real.
That's yes. It's the poles are going to reverse.
You could have talked about the new Apple Store coming to the Highland Village on the same day as the iPad.
This brief Barrett time was less lack of content and more that I just came straight from work. Yeah,
he almost groove-housed us.
I tried to dial in is what I did. Only a little bit less sleepy, yeah. Uh-huh.
You don't have to post that to the website.
You got to post the magnetic solar storm story.
Yeah, after the fact. We won't even be able to read it on the webpage.
Read it now.
2012!
Run around. I'm dying over here.
Well, Slinks, I was going to fly to the North Pole tomorrow. And I guess that's off. Yep.
They're talking about a really nice aurora borealis, as a result of this.
Yeah, there will be some positive effects.
Maybe we'll see it in Texas.
Just can't tweet about it.
Those were just good drugs.
No. There were sober people there to verify. No, seriously.
They had six arms and spoke through their mouth and their forehead.
Look.
But they were real people.
It was a message from God in green and red swirling lights. Swear to God.
They were red and blue.
Huh?
They're red and blue and spoke in a commanding voice.
Pull over.
Yes, I was carted away to a mystical place. Smelled like drunk tank. No.
It was a sobering smell.
You know, it's a good story. I'll tell it to you sometime. It's absolutely true, and it was not like you're making
Let's
it up.
Let's save it for a Barrett time.
Well, we got Barrett time now.
20 more seconds.
You can tell it to Barrett, and then Barrett can retell it to us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
It's like Jay was... Groovehouse has deflected the ridicule and shame onto me.
I'm fine with that. That's fine.
Hey, you were the one seeing red and blue lights and...
Green. I said green.
Green and red and lights in Texas.
Was there probing?
Well, they told me that they had reached the limit of what anal probing could show them.
We can do no more.
713-526-5738. Look, it's the Aurora Borealis. All right, Groovehouse.
Yes.
How about some more of your lip?
Hell!
That's what she said.
Bite it just a little.
Ha 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 ha!
All right, Groove House, who's up next?
All right, up next on the second half of the show, we're going to take Ray.
Ray, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, guys. Good to hear you guys. Hey, letting you guys know, you guys are competing with the PBS Phantom of the Opera. That's the reason you guys are getting low calls, man, tonight.
Yeah, we share a lot of the same audience for opera and, I mean,
crossover.
When I heard you said, I thought you said the CBS Phantom of the Opera.
PBS.
I know it's PBS. It all made sense, but I was just thinking about a CBS version of the Phantom of the Opera might be something that, you know, I could get behind. Some kind of like... You know, CSI opera.
Hey, I had a couple of questions.
Oh, you want to talk about computers too?
When you, if you get a lot of spam from through your email and stuff, is there anything you can do to just eliminate some of that stuff without having to change your email address and so forth?
Well, are you who provides your email?
CenturyLink.
CenturyLink.
They probably don't have the best spam filters.
Yeah,
out there.
They're not. They don't. You know, I obviously changing your email address would help. There are other email services that have very good spam filtering.
Okay.
But you know, I use Gmail and I rarely get spam in my inbox. It usually gets filtered out. That being said, if CenturyLink is your email and you're using that and you want to keep using that because that's how people know how to find you, you could do a couple of different things. One would be to, you know, install some kind of spam filtering software on your computer. I don't really like most of the spam filtering software out there that I've seen lately. Another thing you could do is you could set up a Gmail account and you can configure Gmail to actually pull mail from your other account that you have with CenturyLink.
Okay.
And I think that would actually run through, then run it through the... I had not tried it, but I think
it'll run... It will. It'll bring it through the spam filters. And that way, if you wind up liking Gmail, you can slowly transition over. Yeah, the other way, even on the low way, you could just do a forward, too, to where anyone that emails you to your CenturyLink just forwards straight into the Gmail, and that'll definitely go through the spam filters.
Right. And then you could use the Gmail account to just start replying from there, and you still see all your mail sent to CenturyLink because it would still be coming in, and you would see that in the interface, but you could also use Gmail... then transition yourself to that mail system and get rid of the CenturyLink. One of the things I really like about web-based email, and I like Gmail specifically, but, you know, in a pinch, the other ones will work. They're not as, I don't think they're as glamorous, Hotmail and Yahoo and so forth. But the nice thing about one of those email accounts is that they're portable. So if somebody comes along that gives you better internet access for a better price than CenturyLink, then you're not stuck with, you know, you're not, you know, left hanging when you get rid of your email address.
Well, let me make a point real quick. Actually, the email addresses are coming through my web hosting service.
Oh, so you have your own domain?
Yes, I do have my own domains.
Okay, and, so the email comes to your domain and then it's forwarded to your CenturyLink?
Yeah, it's coming in through CenturyLink, but. The email address is all through my domain.
Well, you can read.
Is this a business domain or is it personal?
They're business domain, basically.
But you could point those to a Gmail account as easily as you could point them to a Century account, and they will get filtered. And you can set up Gmail to reply as using your domain account, you know, your custom email address.
See, I think I was going to say business. I think business Google Apps accounts are. You're supposed to pay for them. If it's personal, you can get them for free. But at that point, you could just point the MX records for that domain to Google, set up a Google Apps account, and then you would have your email going into there. That's where you would read your email. You could pop it or IMAP it down, but you could also read through the web interface. You could send from there. You would also have access to Google Calendar, Google Docs, Google Sites, and all that stuff through your domain.
Email is the only option you guys know of?
Well,
Microsoft has an Office 365, but I'm not sure if it's really for individual users or how much it costs.
Well, it's aimed at small businesses, but it's not expensive.
It doesn't sound like, I mean, if you're just having email forwarded from your domain to a CenturyLink email account, it doesn't sound like you're doing that much, anything that terribly complex that would require Google, you know, Docs account or anything like that. I have several domains. I have geekradio.com, baldheretic.com, so forth. And that email that I have at those domains just forwards to my Gmail account.
And you don't get that? How much of a spam do you get through those accounts?
I get a ton of spam through them, but they all get filtered by Gmail.
Oh, okay.
So I get nothing in my inbox. No spam in my inbox.
Based on that, one quick question: do you when you delete all that spam and all that bad stuff? Do you how much of a memory does it take up on your hard drive?
Well, I do all of my email from the web interface on Gmail, so it takes up no room on my hard drive whatsoever.
Oh, it doesn't?
And okay. I don't have to. I mean, if you want to use a mail client, then the amount of mail that you download to your computer is, you know, that's going to be how much space it uses. I don't know. I couldn't tell you right off the top of my head how much actual mail I have.
Yeah, I use IMAP, so I use Google. And I keep it stored on Google, but then I use IMAP on my laptop. So it pulls down the headers, and then every time I read a message, or the last several days are actually local on my machine. But it doesn't download stuff from the spam folder, I don't think. And by Google, by default, if it detects something as spam, it just puts it in another folder called spam. And if you don't ever look in there, it just auto-deletes it after, I think, 30 days or something.
Right, 30 days. Like, I have 7,000 spam messages in my spam folder on Gmail right now, 7,008 spam messages. But that's 7,000 spam messages that did not make it to my inbox.
That's the reason I was wondering. I mean, how much of space is that these deleted messages taking up on?
Well, once they're deleted, they're not going to take up
any... Like the next couple of years, something like that, even if you have a good hefty hard drive?
Right now, my total amount of mail that I'm using total on Gmail right now, and I've had Gmail since about 2005, 2006, I've got 4 gigs of mail total, 4 gigs of email. And that's a lot of email, and right. Depending on how much, and I get a lot of email because of the column and the radio show and so forth. You can tell right now. You can tell how much mail you have. You can go look at your CenturyLink mail files and see how much mail you have.
Okay.
In terms of size,
you're not concerned with all that spam. I mean, deleted mails and stuff like that. Taking up room on your hard drive that shouldn't be there.
Well, none of this is taking up room on my hard drive because, as I mentioned earlier, I handle it all. It's all stored in my Gmail account online.
Okay. All right.
But you know, if you're concerned about it, right now, however much mail you have that you have not deleted is taking up room on your hard drive. So if you could, huh? No, once you delete it, it's gone.
Oh, really? So it doesn't take up. After you delete it, doesn't take up any of your room on your hard drive.
How much room does the Coke can take up in your trash bag after you throw the trash bag away? Okay. None. If you actually delete it, now that brings up another topic because a lot of people, depending on the email client they use, will delete mail. And now all that does is moves the mail to the deleted items folder.
Or the trash. Whatever it's called.
Okay. And if you don't empty your trash, then it sits there.
Okay, that answers my question pretty much.
All right,
appreciate it, guys.
All right, thanks for your call.
I was gonna say I have email in my Gmail account going back to I think 1997.
In your Gmail account?
Yes.
Because he pulled from his.
I pulled all my mail into Gmail.
How often do you go back and look at email from 1997?
The first 20 or so, fairly often, because I'll go back to the first page. But you know the 7,000 or 8,000 in the like mid 2000s, not very often.
Now, I mean, I've got all my email not in my Gmail account, but I've got mail archives that go all the way back to I think like 93 or so.
Yeah, I wish I still. I've got a reel tape. That I've got email going back to, well, I don't know what the oldest one on there was. It's probably not recoverable anymore. But the first email address I got was in the summer of 1988. So.
Well, my earliest email was all stored on a shell server, so I don't have any of that.
See, mine was on a punch card. Mine was Vax VMS.
I got punch card email, y'all. Come on.
See, mine was Vax VMS. I had somebody when I graduated, I had somebody write it to reel-to-reel tape off of XBMS system, but that tape's probably not recoverable.
I still have snail mail letters.
I still have a lot of them.
I got a letter that, this girl that I liked wrote me from Maine when she moved away in, 1976. That's kind of cool.
That's kind of cool.
My spam folder I'm looking at, I got spam message 824, 822, 8, 751, 736, 732, 731. I mean, they come in five or 10 minutes.
You get a lot of spam.
It was way higher than 7,000. It really ebbs and flows. One time I had like two spams every minute.
Wow.
Coming in.
Yes, the spam levels actually in the last 6 months to a year have cut in by a magnitude of 10.
Yeah. Well, one of the big ones got... Yeah,
there was a big Russian one that went down.
The only thing I still don't... I'm happy enough to have spam filters. One of the things I don't like is that it does occasionally catch real email.
Yes.
And I have missed messages before because they will be detected as spam.
But I think that's true of a lot of stuff. It happens corporately with ours.
No, I think it happens with all... It's one of my pet peeves. I think that... and by having spam filters, I think it takes our mind off the spam and allows spam to kind of keep going. I think everybody should get all the spam that comes in.
I've told people because one of the things I work with is mail gateways and spam detection. And for a long time, I was hand-rolling our mail gateways... and now we use some appliances. But it's one of those things where, before we had any mail gateways at all doing spam filtering, people were getting 10, 20, 50, 100 spam messages a day sometimes. I put my stuff in and it dropped to 2 to 5, and then we set up a separate spam server with a webmail interface you logged into. So it redirected spam to there instead of your regular inbox at all. But then the appliances are even more accurate. And so now it's like somebody gets one or two spam messages in a week and they're complaining.
Oh, I know. I hate that.
And so this comes up and up and up, and I haven't convinced anybody to do it yet. But I'm like, every company should have a spam appreciation day, one day a year that they pick. But not everybody all at once, because then the spammers could abuse it. But every company should have one spam appreciation day where they completely turn off all filtering and let everything for a 24-hour period go into the user's inboxes, because then they would appreciate what they're not having to deal with.
Although, I don't know, we've got some at my company that would probably just have...
a field day.
They would have a conniption fit. One thing if you could somehow... filter the spam to remove the objectionable content. Like you could just say pornographic picture here, placeholder for pornographic picture, marital aid, whatever. But the stuff that actually comes through is pretty offensive. And I think unleashing that on people, unfortunately, would not go over well.
Nobody wants to do it.
But I agree with you 100%. It's like, really? You got to spam this month? And you had to log a ticket with the help desk because you got a piece of spam.
Couldn't hit the delete. Couple times a week is really that difficult.
Yeah, I mean, in my role as a helpline columnist with Eastern Chronicle, back in the early days of Windows 95 and 90 and XP, the thing that everybody wanted was to disable the log. They wanted to bypass the logon on Windows. They just couldn't take the time to hit OK if the password was blank, or type in a quick password. Precious seconds. Precious milliseconds. So, delete it. What's even worse are the people that, when they can't get to email and their partner, their friend, their coworker in the cube next to them can't get to email, it's like, well, maybe email's down. Quick, let's report it. all the other hundreds of employees aren't going to be calling the help desk to let them know that mail's not working.
So is your email getting pulled in that you've got the 7,000? Is that for multiple domains, or is that just for one email address?
That's going to be multiple domains. That's going to be that's all the helpline spam that I get. Stuff that's addressed to me at helpline@cron.com, jakegeekradio.com, flyingfishsailors.com, anywhere. Oh, okay. I've got an email published. Good.
That makes me feel better, because I just looked at mine and I only had 3,800 spam messages, but that's only for one account, one email address.
I clean mine out, and so I don't really notice how many. I just
let Google wipe it after 30 days. I almost never look in there. I probably miss some legitimate messages, but there is no way I'm going in and wading through
there.
That stuff unless somebody tells me they sent me something and I haven't seen it.
I put together a couple of good search phrases that help me find legitimate mail, but I'm sure I've missed some stuff, you know. And unfortunately, I think my stuff, email from me, ends up in people's spam filters, because I get messages from people say, "Why haven't you replied to me?" And I have. So
yeah, see, I just have 813 in there, and I probably deleted it maybe a month ago, so I don't get too bad. That's in Gmail, which is not my primary account.
I don't even delete in Gmail. I just let it delete after 30 days.
I just let it do its
Although,
stuff.
According to Gmail, I'm using 4 gig of my 7.6 gig allotment. So what does that tell me?
So if you clear it out, actually, when you clear out the spam, that goes to your allotment. So if you clear the spam, you'll get a nice boost.
Is there a way to select all?
Yeah, go into it. There's just a link that says delete all spam.
Right. So I'm going to take 7,016 now.
Well, there's just a link that says delete all spam at the top of that box.
I got it. 7,016 spam messages.
See how much it gives you.
I'm currently using 4 gig, and it probably is going to take it away a while to actually run to sleep.
How are you used? What do you have?
Oh, a lot of attachments, probably.
You do photos and stuff. That's probably.
I have a lot of attachments. There's a thing you can run on Gmail called Really Big Mail, and it tells you, it'll set up a
tab. Yeah, see, because I'm using like 900 meg, and that's mail going back to the early 90s.
All right, I'm going to delete forever. We're going to go 90s. From 4.1 gig to see what it goes down to. It says deleting all four, so it might take it a minute to actually run that delete. So while we're waiting on my Gmail, remember the numbers, 4 gig, see what it comes to. All right, 713-526-5738 is the number to call if you want to be on the air. We've got plenty of time to take calls. So, Groovehouse?
Yes.
Who's up?
All right, up next, we're going to take David.
David, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Hey, my computer is slow to boot up. I turn it on, and the Windows deal will come up, and it goes and goes and goes and goes and goes and goes and goes. Sometimes I boot up, then I'll turn it off, then it comes back, and then I'll give me the screen. It turns off suddenly, so do you want to go back to the original web or go through the safe mode? Then I go to safe mode, then it'll boot up.
How old is the computer?
Probably about 4 years old.
About 4 years old. As you use the computer over time, you know, as you install programs, download stuff from the internet and that kind of thing, you know, different things can happen to the computer. First of all, more things get loaded into startup, so the computer has to start loading more things when you first start up the computer. So you've got more and more things that are starting when you boot. That slows down the boot process. If you turn the computer off without shutting it down properly, then you're going to see the message you're talking about.
Right. But then that's what allows me to send it to boot up that way. Otherwise, it would just kind of turn.
So you're saying that when you start it up, it loads and loads and loads and loads, and then you get tired of waiting, so you force it off and restart it?
Yes,
that's like
it off.
Probably one of the worst things in the world you can do to a computer in terms of your software, because if you interrupt the computer while it's trying to, you know, write and read from the disk like that without a clean shutdown, that makes it a little worse. So I would want to address the startup problem. I would want to address what's going on with the computer that's causing it to boot so slowly.
Right.
Have you, in the 4 years that you've owned this computer, have you run afoul of things like spyware and viruses? Have you been infected?
No, don't recall.
Don't recall? Nothing like that's ever come up? That's pretty good. So you are not seeing any, kind of problematic or troublesome pop-ups or anything like that?
No.
No? All right. Well, that's pretty interesting. That's pretty unusual, too, for a four-year-old. I assume this computer's running Windows XP?
Yeah, Windows XP, right. Yeah.
Did you buy it new when you got it, or did you inherit it from somebody?
No, I bought it new.
All right. Do you have the recovery disks for this computer?
Sure do.
All right. One of the things you could consider doing, this is the most dramatic thing you can do, but it is something you should consider doing if you want to take on this challenge. A four-year-old computer is probably due for a software refresh.
Okay.
So that means backing up your important files, your documents, your pictures, and so forth, and then reloading the operating system and then your applications. But before you do something like that, the first thing I would check is, you know, make sure you have plenty of free hard drive space. How big is the hard drive on the computer?
I don't recall.
Well, you need to take a look at how big the drive is as a whole, and then see how much free space you have.
Okay.
You want to make sure you have probably at least 20% free space so the computer can do its business. Another thing you want to consider doing is, you know, defragment the hard drive.
Okay.
If you haven't ever run any basic system maintenance on this computer since you got it, then you should consider doing that for sure. There's some things you can do. There's disk cleanup inside of Windows XP. There's also a defragmentation tool, what they call disk defragmenter. You can defrag that. And then you can consider uninstalling programs that you don't use anymore.
Okay.
Looking at remove programs. If you'll do a Google search on, you know, basic maintenance XP or, you know, slow boot up XP. Don't download or necessarily buy any programs to do it, but look for some websites that talk about basic system maintenance.
Okay.
And see about applying some of that to the PC and see if you can't breathe some new life into it.
All right, that'll work.
All right.
Thanks a lot, guys. Enjoy your show.
All right, thank you for your call.
All right,
so after my big delete of 7,000 spam messages, I went from 4.1 gig to 3.9 gig.
Okay, 200 megs.
That's significant.
200 megs?
That's still significant.
Yeah.
That's a lot. I mean, considering since it's spam, it's probably all text.
Right.
That's significant.
All right. 713-526-5. I was looking at. I can't remember what this thing I ran on my Gmail. It's called My Really Big Mail or My Big Mail, and it gives you three tags: one My Big Mail, one My Really Big Mail, My Ultra Big Mail. And if I look at My Ultra Big Mail, Ultra Big Mail, I'm sure that.
And you were laughing at the name of my computer, Big Baby.
Well, I didn't name this.
Well,
you named my big baby. Whatever.
Whatever.
Red and blue lights.
Hey.
Whatever.
Oh, yeah, that reminds me. I was
driving through town.
Yeah, I was going to do this. This is God.
Yeah. That works.
Studio humor for those listening at home.
We are so funny.
To ourselves.
I don't know. People keep telling us they think we're funny, so.
We got a full bank of calls.
But looks aren't everything,
yeah,
right?
We do have a full bank.
All right. So, Groove House.
Yes.
And the full bank of calls.
Yes.
Who's up?
We're going to the rumor mill. We're going to talk to Christopher.
Christopher, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Turn your radio down.
We're going to the rumor mill. We're going to talk to
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, how are you?
You need to turn your radio down, brother.
No, it's down already.
No, it's not. All right, so what can we do for you?
Well, it's funny because this afternoon I finally got a hold of a friend of mine in Southern California who I hadn't talked to for a while. And we were yapping, catching up on things, and I asked how his brother was doing, and he told me that his brother is now part of a hacker group. And don't quote me on this, but I think the name of the group is called Anonymous. Not Anonymous, but Anonymous, without the A. And they, apparently, are trying to take down the internet at the end of this month. Now, I asked him, isn't it possible, couldn't they do it next week when I'm on spring break? But he said, no, they got to do it at the end of the month. And supposedly, Southern California... Three of their group have already been arrested or investigated or some shit like that. So I thought,
All right, hey, listen.
I'm
going to let you go because you just broke one of the cardinal rules of radio, which is...
I pressed the invisible dump button, but
right, which
happened.
We don't have. So, you know, if you can't watch your mouth, can't be on the air.
No potty mouths.
All right, Groove House.
Yes.
How about somebody more reasonable?
I don't know.
That's asking for a lot, Jay.
I hope everybody out there is reasonable. Let's keep it clean, people.
All right,
I'm not going to put you on the air if you're going to do something silly. All right, up next, we're going to take Ken.
Ken, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
You okay?
What's that?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, today on an Extreme Machine 32-bit, it forced me to upgrade to Media Player 11, which I didn't think was available on for XP, but it forced me into it, and then it wanted to revalidate my operating system, but it only gave me one option, which was to close the program inside the window. It didn't open large enough to have the, you know, accept button displayed. I tried different screen resolutions, and it kept just hiding all the buttons except the close button. So I used the tab to tap through the space, and finally it gave me a small sliver of an accept button, which I could press, and then it would validate the windows inside this media player subroutine. It wouldn't let me validate it on the website, or I didn't like the fact that I could validate it any other way. I had to validate it through the media player validation window. So if anybody else encounters that problem where you're forced to upgrade media player, but you don't see the button to accept the validation, you got to just force your tab to find it at the bottom of the page.
Okay, well, appreciate that tip.
Okay.
All right, thanks. Have a good night.
I think I actually have seen that, not necessarily on Windows Media Player, but if you've got a notebook computer, like particularly like maybe a smaller, like a netbook, and the screen is small, and you don't, and there's no visible way because the designer presumes you have more space than you think you do. I've seen that happen, and really tabbing to it and hitting enter is kind of the only way you can do it.
But you are kind of blind to doing that. You've got to know the tab order.
Yes.
All right. Groove House?
Yes.
Who's up next?
All right, up next, we're going to take Alon Alon.
Alon Alon, you're on the air.
Hey, no beep from me.
That's good.
How's it going, guys? Got a simple question, I hope, but I use a number of different browsers, probably about 60% Firefox and 35% Safari and... rest of it, some other browsers on occasion. But what can you recommend for a software that will consolidate bookmarks between the browsers? I know you can do it within each browser, but sometimes it gets a little confusing between maybe I have different operating systems, like I got two different Mac Minis hooked up to this monitor, and I got to switch back and forth between the old and new processors and all that. So is there any software that you can just put all the bookmarks in one place?
Well, there are tools that will synchronize your bookmarks online so that every web browser you use has access to all of your bookmarks.
Okay.
I don't use these tools. Maybe if Dwight or Barrett are paying any attention to the call right
now. I am. I've moved into pretty much Firefox and Chrome, and the thing I like about Chrome is that it follows me wherever I go, and I like it for developer reasons.
I would just, I just use Chrome, which syncs on multiple platforms and works very well.
There's something that's free. There's Bookmaxter. I'm guessing since you're running Safari that you're on a Mac, and it will merge and manage bookmarks between Safari, Firefox, Google Chrome, Camino, iCab, Opera, Chromium, OmniWeb, and just about any other. So you can actually probably go find some new browsers just through this tool.
Yeah, so what is
it's called Bookmaxter.
Okay.
By Sheep Systems. It's free. I've never used it, so I'm just going by, you know, their site looks credible. A few people have given it good reviews.
What's your hesitation for using Chrome?
Mine?
Yes.
Just haven't tried it. Been satisfied with the other browsers. And I got, you know, a whole lot of bookmarks. And you're talking about emails. I started out with the university system back in the 80s, but I then used mail.com, which gave me the option of using a customized email address, such as my last name at doctor.com, dr.com, or something like that. But I seldom go back there. I still have the account, but I'm mostly Gmail. So it's interesting, that little experiment you did, because I delete my review and delete from my spam folder every day, because every now and then, you know, a message or two will end up in there that shouldn't be. So I want to be sure I'm not deleting something that I want to keep. But I have about 30 plus folders, what they call tags for the emails. So I have to sort them out, keep track of them all that way.
If you're that heavy of a Gmail user, you should probably check out Chrome, you know, especially since you're using other browsers out there. Chrome, I think you're going to like the way that it handles Gmail. So you can actually go and install an app that will, you know, pull up on the Chrome main page, and you can launch into Gmail that way. And I think there's some hooks that take advantage of a WebKit browser, which Chrome is, that you may not see in Safari. Actually, I think Safari is WebKit, but
they both are WebKit.
Yeah, they're both WebKit, but the Firefox is what I was trying to think of.
Well, I'll check it out, and at Bookmaster too. And thanks until next time.
All right, thanks for your call.
The other thing about with multiple browsers is I think all of them can import bookmarks and favorites in a variety of ways, and you know, you can export also in a variety of ways, so
yes,
that
you can
end up maybe we shouldn't go there, but the nice thing is that you're not locked into one particular browser because you have your bookmarks. It's easy to move back and forth between them.
Do you have something to say?
I like to use the import export feature that the browsers provide for moving bookmarks.
We're not talking about moving them.
I'm talking about going to the command line when you want to move bookmarks. That's what I'm talking about.
Let me tell you something, Barry. These features are built into the browser for a reason.
You know what I like to use? Alarm clocks to wake up on time.
Hell,
I like to be at places on time when I say I'm going to be there.
Actually, he used his alarm
I like to
clock.
Live up to, you know, the expectations that I've allowed to be set on my life and be reliable. These are the things that I like. You know, if you can't get up and get to here, how long have you been doing this show?
I don't know.
It's so tired. I don't know. I have no idea. I'm surprised you didn't sleep in late before now.
I did once before.
Yeah, I know.
It's only my second time in like 6 years or something. Yeah.
You know, we had somebody sleep in late and almost miss the show once. Once. All right, 713-526-5738 is the number to call.
I think this is either this month or last month was is my 10-year anniversary on the show.
Really?
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure I started in February or March of 2002.
It all blurs together for me now. Did we get you and then Barrett or Barrett?
I didn't realize you were that close. I thought you'd been around for a lot longer for some reason.
I think, you know,
Afflicted was on the scene.
I know you were both kind of like, you know, kind of found together. It was a
bundle deal.
It was a bundle, yeah. It was a discount if you get two or something.
They were wrapped up in swaddling clothes and placed on the KPFT doorstep.
Well, you got to remember, 2002 was like when the birth of the Geek Gallery was, when the radio show was actually reaching out to the public to meet people or to see people. We hadn't actually ventured out prior to that. So when Pete and I would just sit here in the studio and do our thing, but then we started doing geek gatherings and we actually socialized with our listeners, and that's, you were like cream of the crop right there. Groovehouse just
Mine was actually from the y'all wanted t-shirt design.
Right.
That was how I actually first started, got on the show.
Yeah, you sent in your clever designs and I thought that was funny. And I remember I asked you if you wanted to be on the show and you were like, I don't know. Why would you want me on the show? What can I do? So, well, you're funny. You're funny, man. You're funny. And you you know computers. But, all right. So, you know, another happy story there. And not once has Afflicted slept in late. he's missed the show just because he doesn't want to be here. He's just chosen not to come.
No, Flick did.
No, he has been late.
That one time when y'all were worried about me.
Yeah.
It was because my alarm, I guess I fell asleep and I hadn't set my alarm. Yeah, and I woke up. It was like 45 minutes into the show.
Well, at least you weren't sleeping through an alarm you set. Well, we had a network engineer at Neosoft who literally had to set 5 or 6 alarm clocks. And what that would do is wake his neighbor up, who would then come bang on the door.
Wow.
He could sleep through that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I've got 4 alarms on my phone in the morning and 2 on the clock radio.
It's time for a sleep study, man.
I used to, when I was in college, I would have an alarm that was near me, and then I had a backup alarm that was like across the room. So when I accidentally hit that one on off and was still asleep, the other one would eventually go off and I'd have to get up.
Have you seen an alarm clock where you hit the snooze and then it rolls off your desk and then rolls to the other
side?
They've
got one of those clocky. Yeah, it takes off. You've got to go catch it.
You own one?
Yeah. Amanda has a hard time waking up, so she has all kinds of different kinds of alarm clocks. But yeah,
there was one that somebody made that when the alarm goes off, it shoots off like a helicopter blade flying off. And so you have to actually go get it, find it, and then put it back on top of the thing for it to turn off the alarm.
That's dangerous.
There's the alarm clock that makes bacon. Yeah, but it has a little skeleton. You put in some bacon in there, some frozen bacon, and you stay, and then it'll kind of thaw overnight, and then this thing will just go
away.
And then when the alarm clock goes off, it preheats this thing. It drops the bacon on there, and it sizzles. It's shaped like a little pig.
I don't want to burn my hand hitting snooze. That would be my
thing. Yeah, I don't want to wake up to little burnt pock marks on my face.
You don't have to put it that close. You just wake up to the smell of bacon.
They also make coffee machines with clocks on them that will start brewing coffee in the morning.
See, that goes a long
I'm
way.
Always afraid I'm going to come in and find just a big pool of coffee in my kitchen.
Because you forgot to put
the carafe on there. I don't know. Technology is so confusing.
Technology that makes you breakfast.
You know. All right, so who's up next? Let's just go back to the phones.
All right,
I'm hungry.
I'm hungry.
And I want some coffee.
And bacon. Breakfast. Eggs. All right, up next on The Breakfast Show, we're going to take Dave.
Dave, you're over easy.
Hey, good evening, guys. You don't need an alarm clock if you have the problem I've got.
What's that?
I just completely clean installed Windows 7 on a 4-year-old system and put in 8 gigabytes of RAM from originally 4 gigabyte system, and it only recognizes 4 in the system menu in Windows.
32-bit version
of BIOS recognizes all 8.
Right, but is it a 32-bit version of Windows?
No, I installed 64-bit.
And it's only, and the BIOS sees 8 gigs of RAM.
Right.
And we know
I have surfed the web, I've done all the blogs, I've gone to the Windows help site, and it seems like the only thing left is to keep switching the chips around until something works.
Well, if a BIOS is seeing it,
and it counts 64-bit,
and you're absolutely positive that it's 64-bit
version. I'm positive, because that's what the system menu reports when you go to look at the system information.
Okay, so it reports 64-bit
version. And I bought an OEM Windows 7 version, so it's not got a lot of fancy stuff on it. I installed it all myself.
Do we know for a fact that the computer or the system board supports an 8-gig configuration?
I went to the manufacturer's webpage, plugged in the service tag number, and said, yes, compatible with Windows 7, ready to go to 8.
No, but is it for sure that it supports 8 gigs of RAM?
That's what it says on their webpage when you plug in the service tag.
Okay, all right.
The BIOS seeing it is what's weird.
Yeah, the BIOS is seeing it. That's what confuses me. If the BIOS sees it, I can't understand what it seems to me it's more of a software switch somewhere, because BIOS recognizes it, so the motherboard knows it's there.
Now, is it a major manufacturer, Dell, or
yep,
you said service tag? Is it a Dell?
Yeah,
And I'm just short of paying them their $90 to help me, because I'm just scared to death that they're going to tell me for $90 that all you can do is switch the chips around, and I could have done that without their help.
What's the command line for checking memory?
Mem.
Just mem.
There used to be.
For,
I haven't
for
tried
the RAM
that.
Or for the
no. Yeah, for RAM no. memory. There and I haven't done this in a long time, but it used to be MEM.
Let's say I've got Windows 7.
Was for you 7 can also or, boot yeah. off the CDs or
because
or off a of Linux
some of that
and do
stuff out every time they come out with a new version. So.
If you do there, I think on the boot disks, there's a memory checker on also on Linux distros. On the live CDs,
there is in Windows
checkers.
7 a way to get the
and
memory.
Have you guys messed with the maximum memory in the advanced boot options with Windows 7? Do you know the studio know anything about that?
There is a switch called max memory, and it's supposed to be in the DOS or in the BIOS menu, but I couldn't find anything about that except there was one switch where you could set max memory, and that was blank.
I wonder what it's. I think if you go into the system configuration and then you go into the boot tab and then look under advanced options.
Yeah.
There's a maximum memory box here, and you can either check it or you can not check it.
In which system config?
Again, I don't have a Windows machine in front of me, but it looks like if you go to the system configuration window.
Okay, sysconfig. Yeah.
And then is there a boot tab?
I'm not sitting in front of the computer right now because I was trying to get to sleep and you guys woke me up with...
Well, yeah, just remember boot, advanced,
alarms
and then
taken.
Max memory.
Okay, so it's in the system window when you go to the system
configuration. So start
boot,
system configuration
yeah,
or
that. Yeah, and I did.
You can
I,
even
I,
actually
I
you can type in msconfig
and,
too.
No, it's not checked. It's not checked.
Okay, yeah. Click on maximum memory, reboot it, and see if it shows up then.
So the toggle has to be on for max memory?
I have never had to do
really?
Anything like that in
no,
a system when it comes
huh.
to a
yeah,
memory.
I mean,
upgrade.
See, this is why, I mean, BIOS says it's there. That's what's got me confused.
The other thing, I found that the command you want to try for, to check, to see if from the command line you can see that the memory... is to do system info. System info will give you a huge amount of information, including...
Right, I checked that, and it says that's where it says 4 gigs and not 8.
Well, but from the command line?
Well, when you say command line, you mean...
Start CMD?
Right, type CMD or just command
okay.
from in the text
yeah.
in the search menu, and you'll yep. get a black box.
Okay.
And in there, type system info and hit enter.
Okay, and it should give me everything. And
it'll give you an incredible amount of information. You have to scroll back to find total physical memory.
Okay.
But it should show it to you there if it can see it outside of the GUI.
But if it says 4 there, what does that say?
It says we still have a mystery on our hands.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to get to. So. All I'm trying to resolve tonight is this something easy or is this something that's a mystery? And it sounds like if the system still reports 4, we've got a mystery. Okay.
No, it's definitely a stumper because I have a lot of Dell computers at my office. We have a bunch of engineers and product specialists that wanted to upgrade their systems to 8 gigs of RAM, and we had to take them up from XP to Windows 7 64-bit to address the RAM. And they're all Dells, and they all handle it just fine.
That's what I thought, too. I thought the architecture was well-suited.
There is a...
Now, I did move up from a Vista install, but...
That shouldn't make a difference.
Yeah, it's completely clean installed, so that shouldn't have anything
to do with it. There is a 32-bit version of 7, right, though?
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, and so you know for sure you're...
I know
he
for sure
he says he looked.
Okay. Yeah, I know okay. for sure. I've looked at the system menu, okay. Information menu, and it says 64-bit.
Were you seeing 8 gig in Vista?
Oh no! I didn't have 8 gig installed in Vista. This is a new and this
a
is
a brand
new
machine.
I had the SIM slots, and there were 4 1 gig cards in the 4 SIM slots in Vista, but I bought 4 2 gig cards for it.
You might try booting off the CD and running the memory checker or whatever that's on Windows disks.
Is that on the OEM versions?
Yeah, it's going to be on any of the versions.
And or download a Linux live. Distro like Ubuntu and boot off it, and when you boot off of it there's a memory checker on it, or if you let it boot into Ubuntu you could look in Ubuntu and see how much memory it claims that it has access to.
Which version of Windows 7 is this?
Wow, I can't tell you off the top of my head.
I wonder if it's possible that it's home version.
No, this is is there a premium?
Home premium
business? Yeah.
Now,
There is Starter, and Starter would be the one that would not be able to see it, he would know if he had Starter.
No. This was a one step up from Home. This is what the next one up from Home is Premium.
All right, because some of them have storage. Yeah,
Home just, Premium has 16 gigs max.
All right,
Windows and then Pro and Ultimate 182.
Well, because Windows 7 Home Basic should see 8 gigs anyway.
Yeah, so. No, I'm above Home Basic.
So even if it was Home Basic,
looking at OEM price to do it yourself was a lot cheaper than doing it for Home with all the software extras on it. So I just went with the OEM stuff.
Although I don't know why Windows 7 wouldn't be able to see the memory, I would definitely take a look at seeing if another operating system could. So maybe making some kind of boot disk using a different, like a Ubuntu operating system, or just see if. Now, when you are doing the check for the memory, how are you trying to look to see how much memory you have? Is that also in the system info?
Well, I forced it to go to the BIOS menu, and I looked in that, and that said at 8 gigs. And
right.
Then when I let it boot up to Windows, and I went to the system info, menu tab, and looked at system info, it reported 4 gigs.
That's a real odd one. I do not know.
Now, I have seen on some of the blogs, there's been a couple of hits where people had the problem, and when you scroll down through the blog list, the bottom line basically is keep moving the chips around until something clicks.
I mean, it's possible that there is, like, some issue with the RAM chips themselves, like whatever you bought and put in there.
Yeah.
If they don't match up, if they're mixed, if there's something that causes the OS not to be able to address them, even though the BIOS says it's there. So, I don't know, maybe you've got some...
Doesn't that sound a little far-fetched, though? I mean, if the BIOS sees
it... It does not sound that far-fetched. It sounds... unlikely, with the caveat being that you're seeing it right now.
It's possible, though, that maybe even though the BIOS can see it and recognize what kind of chip it is, that the OS actually can't allocate memory from them because it's going on deeper level of access than the BIOS is.
Right. The BIOS is...
The manufacturer of the chip to say, hey, you know, is that a system-specific issue or is that something that's likely if you take the chip back, they're going to go, oh, yeah, sometimes... Windows 7 can't see these chips.
Where did you get the chips from?
A Micro Center.
I would have the conversation with them. I would go back with the, you know, or call them, or probably have to go in to Micro Center, take the memory chips in, and say, look, I bought these for my computer. I was told they're the right kind.
Yeah.
I put them in. BIOS reports 8 gigs as expected, but my operating system, which is 64-bit, because they'll ask you.
Are they 1 gig or 2 gig?
There are 2 gig chips in 4 SIM slots.
And you already had 2 in there, and so you bought 2 more?
No. There were 4 1 gigs, and I bought 4 2 gigs.
So they're
okay.
Oh, they're
did you buy them paired?
Mm-hmm.
So you bought 2 sets of paired?
Yeah, 2 boxes of 2.
It's all the same then.
Micro Center is real good about taking things back. In fact, you can call them, and they usually will say, yeah, bring them in. And I think that probably is your best
bet. Does the system require all 4 slots to be filled?
I couldn't tell you that. That's where I'd have to pay my money to Dell to find out exactly.
You don't have to pay that. You don't have to pay any money to Dell for that. You take one memory stick out and you see what happens.
Do like I used to fix my old car. Put the condenser in. If that didn't fix it, try the next thing.
Right. Well, take one of the memory sticks out. Take the 4th memory stick out, and then boot the computer up and see if it'll boot up. And if it addresses see if you see 6 gigs of RAM in the BIOS,
right.
And then see if you see 6 gigs of RAM in the operating system.
Yeah, and I thought about taking like 2 out and putting 2 1 gig sticks in the other 2 slots and seeing if it reported 6.
That's a worthwhile experiment.
Okay. All right.
Now you're up now.
Really, what's got me stumped is BIOS sees it, the system doesn't.
Well, the BIOS sees that their chips are there. The operating system says I can't address it for whatever reason. And I mean, you know, it could be something as ridiculous as not having your memory seated properly. We had a guy call in.
Yeah.
You know, so double check the seating, and if you need to, take the 2. Just take them and take the 2 first ones and the 2 last ones and swap places with them.
Some newer operating systems are really particular about paired memory, and so if you just got the 2 flip, that should be the 2 slots with the paired ones. Then
It's possible.
So if I bought two that were two together and I flip-flopped them with the other two, you're saying they might not have been paired properly.
That's possible.
I mean, I haven't installed memory in a while, but I've heard people talk about, like, pairing chips being more prominent now than it used to be.
And also look at the chips, too, and make sure that they are all exactly the
same.
They're
all exactly the same. I know that for a
fact. And you looked at the labels on the chips themselves.
Okay. The boxes were exactly the same and everything.
So that's probably fine.
All right. Well.
All right. Okay, guys. Well.
Good luck.
Wake up on time tomorrow morning.
All right.
Okay, guys.
All right. Bye. All right. Groove House?
Yes.
Groove House.
Yes.
Wake up.
I'm up. I'm up. All right. I got my headgear on.
Who's up next?
All right, in the speed round, we're going to take Joe.
Joe, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, how's it going, guys? Great fan of the show, all right?
All right.
Hey, I have this issue. I split up my partition so I can test out that new Windows 8, right? Now, I split it up 50-50, but now I wanted to allocate more space to the primary, the first primary partition. But it won't allow me to do it because I'm splitting the Windows 8 partition in half now, and the allocated space from that one I'm trying to put in the first primary partition, but it doesn't allow me.
Which operating system are you working from to change the partition? 7 or 8?
I'm working on Windows 7.
Okay. First of all, you're going to have to resize the Windows 8 partition to shrink it a little bit.
That's what he wants to do, and he's trying to do it from the Windows 7 partition. Have you tried to do it from Windows 8?
No, Windows 8, it's already been partitioned.
No, but what we're saying is you could resize a Windows partition using Windows, but you might have to do it from Windows 8 instead of from Windows 7.
Well, I'm not sure if that's absolutely true.
Because of the way Windows 8 is. Windows 8 is the newer operating system.
But if you're using Windows 7 to mess with the partition sizes, it should just look at the partition size and allow you to size or resize it. But Windows 8 may be locking it into that size.
So do it from Windows 8. That's the suggestion I'd make. If it's not working from 7,
try it from 8. But can you shrink the 8 partition and the boot point while you're in 8?
That's what I'm suggesting.
You can, yes.
Yes.
Say that one more time.
I don't think we have time, but we have. We're talking about go into Windows 8 and resize a partition
from there.
From Windows 8.
Okay. All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate
all right. Good luck. Thanks for your call. And I apologize to Levi. We don't have. We don't have time to take his how to view old videos question. Although that sounds like it might be very interesting.
Call next week.
Call next week or email us. Contact us via the website. Tell us what your situation is, and we'll offer our best advice. All right, well, thanks for tuning in, unless you didn't because you overslept.
In that event, you can listen to the podcast.
They're not even going to be awake to hear us tell them to do that. I would have listened to the podcast if I... No! All right, well, thanks for tuning in. This has been Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And he's...
The Roof House.
We'll see you next week for more Technology Bites.
Many of you have been longtime listeners and supporters of KPFT. This station asks you to consider establishing a bequest in your will that benefits KPFT. Supporting KPFT with a legacy gift is an easy decision to make. The future growth and excellence of our station depends on our ability to also build a permanent base of support through an active and successful legacy gift program. The next time you meet with your advisors to review your estate or long-term financial plans, please remember you can include KPFT. Ensure your commitment to public broadcasting continues on. With the help of your attorney, a bequest is simple to put in place. If you need help or have questions, call our development director at 713-526-4000. Again, that's 713-526-4000. Please join listeners like you in helping to ensure that the independent voice of KPFT will be preserved for generations to come. Name KPFT as a beneficiary in your will today. This is KPFT Houston.
It's
KPFT's 42nd birthday, and we're throwing a party on Sunday, March 11th. Come on down. The lineup this year includes Hayes Carl, Ray Wiley Hubbard, Marley's Ghost, Lisa Morales, Patrice Pike, Sarah Hickman, and the Sideshow Tramps. There'll be a raffle and silent auction and even more surprise in the works. Visit kpft.org for more details. Advance tickets are $25 and funds benefit KPFT. It all happens under the big top at McGonigal's Mucky Duck, noon till 7 p.m. at 2425 Norfolk in Houston. Don't forget, Sunday, March 11th from 12 till 7 at 2425 Norfolk in Houston. This is Pacific Radio, kpft.org, twitter.com/kpft, facebook.com/kpfthouston.
Out on the ice, things get pretty rough. But it's nothing compared to what animals and pasture farmers' slaughterhouse go through. Did you know that because the meat industry pumps chicken full of drugs?